Good evening. Rent protections for thousands run out in New York as stimulus talks in Washington go down to the wire. New York State sues to shut down the NRA, a report from Lebanon, and 75 years since Hiroshima. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, August 6, 2020. Lawmakers are increasingly pessimistic about the chances of a quick agreement as negotiations over a fifth coronavirus relief bill go down to the wire. Congress and the White House are barreling toward an end-of-the-day Friday deadline. Senator Chris Coons, a Delaware Democrat, said the odds of a deal by Friday are at best 50-50. According to the Labor Department, a seasonally adjusted 1.2 million new people applied for unemployment benefits in the week ending August 1st. More than 31 million Americans remain on the jobless rolls through mid-July, and the July jobs report, which will be released Friday, is expected to show a sharp slowdown. Meanwhile, thousands of New Yorkers are facing eviction after an order banning evictions in the state ran out last night. Yesterday, tenant activists took their concerns to the offices of real estate attorneys Stern and Stern. The eviction ban had applied to families that got eviction notices prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. Marshals could start issuing eviction notices to those families as soon as Thursday if the orders aren't extended. Mayor de Blasio put the blame on the impasse in Washington earlier today.
There's been constant back and forth with the governor's team. I've been very, both in our private conversations, public conversations with Albany, that we must have a resolution. And the governor's a piece of it, and the legislature's a piece of it. The best thing to do would be when the legislature comes back, which, as I understand, could be this month or next month, pass a law creating a payment plan so anyone who simply can certify, you know, objectively and factually that they just don't have an income source can stay in their apartment, sign on to a payment plan, and pay back the rent when they do have an income source. That's how we could, I think, fix a lot of this problem. Obviously, the rental assistance from the federal government would be an even more profound solution, but it doesn't look in reach at this moment. Now, that might change. Whoops, that might change in a few months, because Washington might change in a few months. But I also want to make sure we are being as smart and flexible as possible to avoid economic evictions. There may be some evictions under certain circumstances for totally other reasons that are pertinent, but the economic ones I want to see us avoid.
Mayor Bill de Blasio, tenants unable to pay rent due to financial hardships during the COVID-19 crisis are protected under the Safe Harbor Act signed by Cuomo in late June. According to the Legal Aid Society, there are about 14,000 families that face eviction, 2,200 for lease violations, and 11,500 for non-payment. A property owners group says almost 18% of residential tenants didn't pay rent in July. And New York State Attorney General Letitia James announced a lawsuit today that aims at closing down the National Rifle Association.
My office filed a lawsuit against the National Rifle Association to dissolve the organization in its entirety. For years of self-dealing and illegal conduct that violate New York's charities law and undermine its own mission.
James went on to list the allegations against the gun rights group.
Altogether, lavish trips for themselves and their families, private jets, expensive meals, and other private travel. Wayne LaPierre, Woody Phillips, Joshua Powell, and John Frazier instituted a culture of self-dealing, mismanagement, and negligent oversight at the NRA that was illegal, oppressive, and fraudulent. They overrode and they evaded internal controls to allow themselves, their families, and favored board members, employees, and vendors to benefit through reimbursed expenses, related party transactions, excess compensation, side deals, and waste of charitable assets without regard to the NRA's best interest.
The attorney general said behind the scheme was the organization's chief executive, Wayne Robert LaPierre Jr. His salary as head of the organization is about $1 million a year. But according to James, LaPierre actually got tens of millions of dollars from the organization for himself and his family.
Mr. LaPierre exploited the organization for his and his family's financial benefit and the benefit of a close circle of NRA staff, board members, and vendors. Specifically, Mr. LaPierre spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of the NRA's charitable assets for personal private plane trips for himself and his family, including extended family when he was not present. He visited the Bahamas by private air charter at least 8 times in an approximate 3-year period with his family at a cost of more than $500,000 to the NRA. He traveled on multiple luxury hunting safaris in Africa at the expense of an NRA vendor. He spent millions of dollars on unwanted travel consultants for decades, including for the booking of luxury black car service. In the past 2 years alone, Mr. LaPierre spent more than $3.6 million on these travel agent services. He secured a post-employment contract for himself with the NRA without board approval, currently valued at more than $17 million. He allotted several million dollars annually in NRA funds for private security costs for himself and his family without sufficient oversight.
And she said the alleged wrongdoing included cheating the IRS through illegal pass-throughs of expenses that should have been declared as income.
These expenses did not comply with IRS requirements, and as a result, all such expenses should have been included by the NRA in taxable personal income for Mr. LaPierre and other recipients. In 2017 and 2018 alone, just 2 years, Ackerman McQueen was paid more than $70 million.
James added that LaPierre and his associates, when confronted by members of the NRA's board of directors, would retaliate by setting other board members against them. The state of New York, she says, wants nothing less than to shut down the organization.
Altogether, there are 18 causes of action. And these actions violated multiple laws, including the laws governing the NRA's charitable status, false reporting on annual filings with my office and the IRS, improper expense documentation, improper wage reporting, improper income tax withholding, failure to make required excise tax reporting and payments in excess of reasonable compensation to disqualified persons, and waste of NRA assets, amongst other offenses. For these years of fraud and misconduct, we are seeking an order to dissolve the NRA in its entirety, to require Mr. LaPierre, Mr. Phillips, Mr. Powell, and Mr. Frazier to make full restitution for funds they unlawfully profited and salaries they earned while employees and pay penalties, to remove Mr. LaPierre and Mr. Frazier from the NRA's leadership, and to ensure none of the four individual defendants can ever again serve on the board of a charity in New York State. It's important to note that Mr. Phillips and Mr. Powell have left the NRA. It's clear that the NRA has been failing to carry out its stated mission for many, many years, and instead has operated as a breeding ground for greed, abuse, and brazen illegality.
New York State Attorney General Letitia James. James adds the action against the NRA is similar to a lawsuit that forced the Trump Foundation to shut its doors last year. While the case could wind its way through the courts for years, observers say it may have the effect of reducing big donor contributions before the November election. The NRA is a strong supporter of President Trump's reelection. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Angry crowds in Beirut, Lebanon are demanding political change in Lebanon as the nation mourns a terrifying explosion that killed at least 157 and injured upwards of 5,000. Some report up to a third of the city was wrecked. More bodies are expected to be retrieved in an ongoing search and rescue operation in and around the port. There were also growing calls inside and outside the country for an independent investigation into the disaster. French President Emmanuel Macron visited the city today and was surrounded by hundreds of people calling for revolution and the downfall of the governing regime. A member of the opposition Citizens in a State political party is Rania Masir. She joins WBAI from Lebanon.
I was home. I live several kilometers away from the coast, and I thought we were hit by an earthquake. And my first impulse was to laugh, thinking this is just what we need. We're struggling through an economic bankruptcy. We got hit with the COVID-19 pandemic. We had, what else could happen in the country? Oh, earthquake. Yes, that's what we were missing. And so I actually took it laughing when the apartment moved horizontally. But then a minute or two afterwards, we felt the explosion. And it really was a sonic boom. It was the most terrifying thing I've ever experienced. And I've lived through several wars in Lebanon, and I've experienced nothing like it. The strength of the explosion was so strong that they felt it 180 kilometers away in Cyprus. I'm one of the fortunate ones. My apartment barely got damaged. I am fine. Most everyone that I know is safe and fine. The country has been transformed. Our city has been ruined. We have lost our main functioning port. More than 5,000 people are wounded, and more than 130 people have been killed that we know of, and more than 300,000 people have been rendered homeless, all by an explosion that was caused by criminal negligence. And we're talking here about 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate. The Oklahoma city bombing of the federal building in 96 had approximately 2 tons of ammonium nitrate. So just you can make the comparison there.
Our president, the first thing he said, and I was listening to him when he said it, and I was in shock, a terrible attack. What did you feel? Did you think it had something to do with Lebanon's enemies or neighbors or the internal conflicts within Lebanon?
I have yet to see any evidence that points to an attack. There's lots of conspiracy theories. I wouldn't put it past our enemy. I wouldn't put it past the Israelis to conduct such an attack. But there is no evidence as of yet. The evidence so far shows that this is an act of criminal negligence. Even if there were an outside attack that caused this, the ones that are responsible remain internal, because they knew for 6 years that they were improperly storing 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate. All those in the successive Lebanese governments for the past 6 years who are legally responsible for the proper storage and management of the facility in our main functioning port. They are the ones that are responsible. So I would even go, even if it were an external attack. Yesterday, one of the individuals responsible for the port said, and I'm quoting here, "Oh, I didn't think it was going to be that dangerous. I knew it was problematic. I just didn't think it was going to be that bad."
What you're seeing in the streets of Beirut right now, the anger, the protests, could that develop into things we saw in Cairo and Tunisia and places like that?
We've had national protests since October 17. People have been taken to the streets since October 17. But will we be able to protest in an organized fashion with clear political demands, with clear focus? So it's not simply protest, but it actually becomes a revolution. And I'm not so certain. I hope so, because if not, then this might be our last opportunity. But I can't tell you, Paul, that yes, I believe that can happen. But I believe it's our only option out of these successive tragedies.
Anything you'd like to add?
My first cry is anyone in the U.S. that wants to support us, it needs to start by lifting sanctions. Any sanctions that are imposed against Lebanon.
Talk about the sanctions.
There have been sanctions imposed on Lebanon, particularly banking sanctions, because the U.S. government feels that if they impose sanctions against individuals that they deem to be problematic, that it won't impact others. But more problematic than the sanctions, you know, against individuals in Lebanon are the Trump sanctions against Syria, the U.S. CSAR Act. Those are sanctions that not only are criminal against the people in Syria, but also hinder any ability for Lebanon to reconstruct and to rebuild and to become a decent country. Please put pressure on your representatives to repeal the U.S. CSAR Act, not simply to give us exception. And then, of course, we can work together.
I see. So you're saying that the sanctions that are aimed at Syria have a spillover effect onto Lebanon?
Yes, they do.
The U.S.'s conflict with Iran is attacking Hezbollah, which is part of the government in Lebanon, and therefore they are sanctioning Lebanon as well as Syria.
Yes, that becomes part of it, yes.
Is Hezbollah an outside force that's imposing itself on Lebanon, or do they represent a real part of the population there?
Hezbollah is one of the largest and most influential political parties in Lebanon. And it needs to be regarded as such, as a political party functioning in the country. Unfortunately for all of us, this very significant political party is still part of the sectarian political system. And it is continuing to defend the sectarian political system within Lebanon that is problematic to everyone, including Hezbollah.
Rania Masir, she joined us from Lebanon. And 75 years ago today, a single United States aircraft flew above the Japanese city of Hiroshima. It dropped one bomb, codenamed Fat Boy. Within seconds, an explosion equal to nearly 20,000 tons of TNT flattened the city, and by radiation as well as blast, eventually killed 140,000 people. The city of Hiroshima marked the day as it does every year.
In this ritual, pure water collected from 17 locations in the city is solemnly offered to the victims who died in the flames while seeking water on this day 75 years ago.
As the generations of Americans who fought in World War II leaves us, the nation's memory of the world's first uses of nuclear weapons in combat is fading at the wrong time, when the threat of nuclear escalation and potential conflict is growing. Few Americans might know the President of the United States has sole and total power to launch a nuclear attack, followed by an aide carrying launch codes and a briefcase known as the football everywhere the president goes. Gar Alperovitz is a leading historian of the Cold War between Russia and the United States. He says, like it or not, Trump has his fingers solely on the atomic trigger.
The fact is that one person, in this case, Donald Trump, has the capacity to order the destruction of the world. I mean, that's, you just have to get your head around that. And it's, I mean, hopefully there are people in the military who might actually disobey his order, if it was crazy. But they would be disobeying an order. They'd be going against everything they've ever signed on to and sworn they wouldn't do. It is a very, very, I mean, people just have to stand back. One person, in this case, Donald Trump, has the power to literally destroy the world. If he set off a, you know, massive nuclear winter, which he probably would if he used nuclear weapons. So it's a very dangerous situation. Quite apart from Donald Trump, there has been almost, the Obama administration did almost nothing on arms control and disarmament. There hasn't been an effort to roll things down rather than up. In fact, the Obama administration launched a massive rebuilding and modernization of nuclear weapons. Trillions of dollars are being committed over the next period of time, committed by the Obama administration and now by the Trump administration. Nobody has taken seriously in for some time the notion of how do we roll this downward rather than how we roll it up. And there's difficulties in Central Europe with the intermediate weapons as well. In other words, the only way this can go forward is if citizens really rebuild a new movement to control nuclear weapons worldwide. And I think that's that. If you look at the most dangerous thing that Donald Trump teaches us, is it does not make sense to have these kinds of weapons available to people who might be elected, who have anything like the character of the current president or others who might make a mistake.
Gar Alperovitz is a leading historian of the Cold War. He helped Daniel Ellsberg distribute the Pentagon Papers, the secret government history of the Vietnam War. And Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Martin Sherwin is author of Gambling with Armageddon, Nuclear Roulette from Hiroshima to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Sherwin says it's been long understood that the power to destroy civilization shouldn't be in the hands of one or two people.
I don't think that any single human being should be able to cause a war that will end life on Earth. And President Trump is certainly not somebody one can have a lot of confidence in. In this book, Gambling with Armageddon, I talk about a very detailed analysis of the Cuban Missile Crisis and Kennedy's thinking. I think the next to last day before it ended, he told a very close friend of his, it's insane that two people on opposite sides of the earth could cause an end to humanity.
Are they weapons? I've heard it said they're really not truly weapons in the classical sense of a weapon because you can't really use them.
There is this mythology of deterrence that these are weapons that are deployed in order to prevent a war. And the argument is that in the 75 years since 1945 in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we have not had a war with nuclear weapons, and therefore they have worked. Well, that reminds me of this New Yorker cartoon of many years ago where an executive is looking out at about the 30th floor of the Empire State Building. And this guy is falling down, and he says, how's it going? And he says, so far, so good. That's where we are. These are weapons that will be used by accident or design at some point as long as we leave them around.
What's the answer?
The answer is getting rid of them. But how to do that can only be designed by the United States. Back in 1945, when Henry Stimson briefed the new president, Harry Truman, on April 25th on the Manhattan Project, he said in his memorandum, because of our leadership in the war and our leadership in this weapons development, we have a responsibility for any disaster to civilization that these weapons create that we cannot shirk. That should be carved into the walls of Congress and the White House. We are committed to first use of nuclear weapons. The Russians are not. The Chinese are not. This is something that we have to reverse.
They've already pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, and it looks they've pulled out of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces deal. And then next year, they're talking about pulling out of the SALT START treaty.
We have to do everything we can in order to make sure that Trump is not reelected. He is a danger, not only to American democracy, but he's a danger to the human species. This is the most important issue, even more important than the environment, because a nuclear war can ruin the environment just in one quick day.
And that's historian Martin Sherwin, the author of Gambling with Armageddon, Nuclear Roulette from Hiroshima to the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Manhattan Project was the name of the enterprise that built the first atomic bombs. The director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University is Peter Kuznick. He co-wrote the documentary series The Untold History of the United States with filmmaker Oliver Stone. Kuznick says the history of the nuclear enterprise has been a lie from the start. The bomb wasn't necessary to stop Japan, a defeated country facing a double invasion from the U.S. and Soviet Union. He says every other city in Japan had already been bombed into oblivion, and that the attacks against Hiroshima and Nagasaki were really a demonstration for the Soviet government.
There were about 140,000 to 150,000 dead in Hiroshima by the end of 1945, 200,000 by 1950. So Tokyo deaths was terrible. The firebombing was terrible. And as even LeMay had admitted, McNamara tells us that he thought that they should have been tried as war criminals if we lost the war because of the firebombing. Hiroshima and Nagasaki to the Japanese leaders were terrible, but they had not fundamentally different what occurred before. It could have been 1,000 planes and 10,000 bombs, or one plane and one bomb. The Japanese leaders accepted that we could wipe out their cities. What changed the equation was not the atomic bombings. What changed the equation was the Soviet invasion at midnight on August 8th. And now that, and that was what forced the Japanese surrender. And we knew that was going to be the case. We knew that the Joint Intelligence Committee to the Joint Chiefs of Staff reported on April 11th, quote, if at any time the USSR should enter the war, all Japanese will realize that absolute defeat is inevitable. We knew that the Soviet invasion would end the war. We knew the atomic bombs were unnecessary. We do let the Japanese keep the emperor after the war. But the United States chose to use the atomic bombs, and we did so, in part at least, to send a message to the Kremlin that if they interfered with America's plans in Europe or the Pacific, this is what they were going to get, and worse, and much, much worse. And we have this from the words of Leslie Groves, who was the head of the Manhattan Project. Groves said there was never, from about 2 weeks from the time I took charge of this project, any illusion on my part that Russia was our enemy and the project was conducted on that basis. Now, that wasn't the view of the scientists who started the project, but that was certainly the view of Groves, and it was a review, and it was the view of James Burns, who was Truman's chief advisor on these issues. It's a history that most Americans don't know, but that they need to know.
A huge controversy a number of years back when there was an exhibit and they brought in the guy who flew the plane who was outraged. Tibbetts was outraged that they forced, I think it was the Smithsonian, to withdraw their exhibit and to change it and to take out any self-criticism of the United States at all.
Well, the World War II generation, sadly, is largely gone. This is the time we see what's happening now with slavery, with the history of American racism. We see what's happening with Native Americans, even gender history. Americans are rethinking portions of their past that are very unpleasant. History is not about the past. History is the need to understand the past so we can create a decent future.
Peter Kuznick is director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. And that's some of the news for Thursday, August 6th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News from New York, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.